Okay, GM, this is Espresso from the Angel's Wing account, and I think it's time to start.
GM, everyone.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
There.
Hello.
Hello, friends.
That's great. We have the crew and people are joining in. That's great. So we'll get started and we are recording as usual and we'll publish afterwards. Welcome to the Angel's Wing Weekend Chat. And this week we have an exciting topic of generative art, talking about January, which is this month, which is an event. We'll get all into what that's about. And we have the amazing Peter Pasma as a guest today. Very honored to have you on. And before we get started, let's do the usual introduction of the Angel's Wing by our co-host Casper, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks very much, Espresso. So we are the Angel's Wing, an international NFT art gallery and podcast show founded by friends around the world who met through our beloved Meta Angels project. Espresso and Johannes are from Europe, Yoon from the US, and Rebel and myself are from Asia. We are driven by our common passion to showcase independent artists and their art and helping them stand out from the crowded NFT market that's pretty much dominated by generative 10K PFP projects. We showcase the art in an on-cyber virtual gallery as a larger collection of art brings a cross-pollination of viewership, and that has helped quite a few of our artists reach collectors through sales. We've organically grown since into a community of artists and collectors, but most importantly, friends, with regular Twitter spaces like these, which are then recorded into podcast formats in Spotify and YouTube. You can check them out later. The easiest way to get in touch with us would be to join our cozy Discord. Everything's on our link in our bio, so just hit us up if you're an indie artist who needs help featuring your art, or if you just want to join a friendly art NFT community. Last but not least, we'd like to mention that nothing on this show should be construed as investment advice. This podcast is for informational purposes only. And that's it. Back to you, Espresso.
Thank you, Casper. So yes, today, as mentioned, have Peter Pasma on the show. Very happy about that. And Peter is an esteemed generative artist with lots of different long-form generative art drops and also one of the key people behind January. First of all, wanted to say hi and ask you, Peter, to introduce yourself and talk a bit about your background, how you got started with creative coding and the journey.
For sure. Thank you for introducing me and all the kind words. Very happy to be on the show. So I'm a generative artist. I'm from the Netherlands. I started creative coding really long time ago. In some sense, like my second program I ever wrote was already like a creative modification to make some cool stuff appear on the screen. And I was 9, but that was a super simple program, just a few lines of basic. Later on, when I got a bit older, I got into the demo scene around 97, 98, 99, and 2000, I think, about that time. Then I released a couple of, I should explain what is the demo scene. It's like a computer art scene that focuses around showing off the programmer skills in showing how much they can make the machine do, in a sense. It started quite early with older computers. For a long time, the demo scene was ahead of the computer games industry in terms of graphical capability. This changed as soon as a video game started getting like Hollywood size budgets, but this was still the case in the early 2000s. I think that's about when it changed, maybe. Yeah, then I studied computer science for a long time. Didn't have a lot of time for the demo scene, but I always kept experimenting with creative code and sound and graphics and all sorts of weird experiments. Then in 2019, I got on Instagram and started posting some of my art, and I got a huge response, and I was a little bit surprised about that. But then I got invited to the Generative Artist Club, and got to know a lot more generative artists also via Instagram itself. I just got to know a whole lot of people. We got into NFTs because it was a big thing and generative art was a big part of it. That's a little bit of the story of how I got started.
Thank you. Yeah, that's super interesting. And several things there we want to get into more as well. And I loved the call out of the demo scene. It really feels like today's generative art kind of originates in many ways from the demo scene early days. So that's amazing. And I see, June, you have a question.
Yeah. Hi, Peter. So you mentioned that before you entered the NFT space, you showcased your art on Instagram. Was that the only kind of generative art community where people shared the art that they made, or were there also like other types of community?
The main reason I got on Instagram was because I thought it was a nice low-key way to stay in contact with people I met in real life, actually. But then I didn't know what to post and I didn't feel like posting pictures of my lunch. So I started posting my computer art. And that's why I got on Instagram mostly. And when I started January, I made it a point to make it not an Instagram thing. And I promoted it on Instagram, on Twitter, on Reddit, probably on some other generative art places that I can't really think of right now. A few Discord servers, of course. But Discord servers, well, for my feeling, also only really took off after the NFTs got quite big as a main way of communicating. Yeah, I registered my Twitter account because of January, actually. I quit Twitter 7 or 8 years ago because it was taking too much of my time. But now I'm only follow artists and art-related people and not just accounts that I think are funny or interesting, so that I hardly ever feel the need to read my Twitter feed, to be completely honest. But yeah, other communities. Well, there was the demo scene back in my early university days. I also was quite actively reading, not so much posting, a little bit on the Eugene generative art mailing list. And that was the first time I heard about generative art. But back then, I didn't think it was very interesting because it was all very experimental and conceptual. And coming from the demo scene, I was used to a lot higher level of graphical fidelity, so to say. But the concept behind all the generative stuff really intrigued me always. I think generative made the most sense to me to use as a tag on Instagram at the time, because the demo scene is really also focused on real-time graphics and real-time audio. So when a piece of generative art even takes half a second to render, you can't do that in the demo scene because it needs to run at 60 frames per second. And that was one thing about the demo scene that I'm actually quite relieved to be able to leave behind, because I think artistically, I can make so much more interesting things without being limited to just doing everything in 1/60th of a second. And what was the question again?
You answered the question already. It was about where you shared your art before you entered the NFT space. I also wonder, was there already a way to monetize generative art before that? I mean, did people like sell prints?
People did sell prints. They weren't going for the prices that they're going now. Well, the first job I got as an artist and that I got paid for, actually, that was completely lucky. Or, well, maybe the stuff they saw just was good, but some Danish graphics design agency contacted me, said they wanted to use the outputs of a particular piece of mine as the graphical style for a electronic music festival in Copenhagen. That was really cool. It was very nice that the first thing that as a digital artist I could actually sell was digital, because all they wanted were the files in vector format and they were going to do all the graphic design and all the stuff, except the pandemic hit and the festival didn't go through. But somehow I did get paid. I probably got the Danish government to thank for that, because I can't imagine where the money would have come from. I used that money to buy my plotter, which is a drawing robot that you screw a pen, any kind of pen, into it, and it moves over the paper in exactly the way that you program it. It's a blind machine. It can't feel the pen. It can't feel the paper. And it does exactly what you tell it to do, even if it's a bad idea. But that's a challenge. I got it because I wanted to have control over the entire process. I sort of felt like I didn't really feel digital art by itself had much value. And that was mainly because of the general attitude towards it. I never considered that digital art itself could be worth something. So I figured that if I send my image file to a printer and they have this big machine, then it's that big machine making the print and their years of experience making it look good. And I wanted some kind of art that I could say, I did this. So that's why I got the plotter. Also because I saw a lot of other generative artists working with the plotter and it seemed interesting to me. Turned out to be quite an interesting journey getting a plotter because it's very limited in what you can do with it. It can only draw lines. It can't erase lines. It can't very well draw lines on top of each other. It actually destroys the paper if you try that too much. And this is like all sorts of restrictions that you have to take into account. It was really a case of limitations breeding creativity because I developed a lot of very interesting pieces and algorithms to do certain things on the plotter.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the plotter machine because I've been very curious. So you already answered that in depth. Is this actually a custom-made machine? Because you said it's basically a robotic arm that holds drawing tool.
No, it's developed by a company called Evil Mad Scientist. They're at evilmadscientist.com. And the machine is called an AxiDraw. I don't know where their biggest market is for these devices, but they're big among generative artists and also architects really like them. And I think there's a certain nostalgia factor about it as well, because the original plotters from HP in the 80s, they were actually machines that predate printers, because back in those days, printers, they would be like these loud, noisy dot matrix type of printers or daisy wheel printers, and they could only either make dots or even just letters. And if you wanted architectural drawings, you needed a plotter, and that would be one of the machines made by HP in those times. I've seen a few videos of those, and they're much, much faster than the AxiDraw. But the AxiDraw is more of open. I don't really like messing around with the electronics, but you can if you want to. And you can screw many different kinds of pens into it. And if you're creative, you can attach pretty much anything to it. People do amazing works with watercolor, for instance, because you can program the device to lower the brush into a particular spot where the paint reservoir is, and then have it dip in and make multiple colors. I don't know if this is her name also on Twitter, but on Instagram, it's blah, blah, paper, blah. But yeah, I should spell that probably, but it's blah with an H at the end. So maybe someone can find it. But her work is really amazing. It's something that I always want to do, but then every time I start thinking about it, I think how messy it would be if I tried it, and then I don't. But yeah, you can do a lot with plotters.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, and I think also my impression is that plotters is a fairly big part of the generative art community. Like that, many artists, as you mentioned, many people who work with plotters have plotters at home, and some people specialize in making only generative art that can be plotted, right? And also, it seems like in your project, it seems to have gotten to be a big focus lately with your last three drops, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, it's several reasons. I think it was already before I decided to get a plotter, or I figured I was going to get a plotter in the future, that I was already focusing on the SVG file format as an output for most of my art. And this is a vector-based file format, which means that it describes the shapes in forms as lines, curves, circles, as was basic geometric shapes. And the end result of that is that these files are resolution independent. You can print them at any size and they won't have blocky pixels in them like a JPEG or a PNG file would, which are the other type of base file formats for images, which are pixel based. And this was partially because I was a bit annoyed by the fact that every time I would render my files at what I thought was a high resolution, a few months later, I always tend to wish I would have made them bigger. I've been using computers for a long time, and I haven't really gotten used to the enormous amounts of disk space we had. So I felt bad about creating 30 megabyte PNG files. I'd rather create 30 megabyte SVG files because, well, they were like resolution independent. They also are a text-based file format, a bit similar to HTML. This was on one hand nice because they're easy to write, so I could write my own SVG writer. The other cool thing is that you can write comments in them that get ignored when you load them as an image. But when you open them in a text editor, you can just see the comments. I've been putting my code into these comments for a very long time. So all my SVG outputs, almost all of them, there's a few exceptions, projects out there that don't do this, especially for the recent plottable pieces that I make. They all include their full source code in every output. So if you right-click save one of the outputs of, say, geomorphism or industrial devolution, the code is included. Nowadays, I do it because it's cool for the longevity of the project, keeping everything together, making sure that the artwork is potentially reproducible. Initially, I started doing this for myself because it was very useful to be able to get like that particular version of the source code that created that particular image and keep them together as one file. Was very easy for cataloging stuff. One part is the file format. Could you explain a little bit more about those last couple of projects, which are made with a ray hatching algorithm? But I don't know, maybe you had other questions.
We definitely want to hear more about the last projects with this ray hatching algorithm that you've released 3 drops so far with this, right? In addition to a 101, if I count correctly. And geomorphism being the latest and this industrial devolution being the first, if I'm correct.
The industrial devolution would be the first long form project with this engine. Before that, there are several ones that also use my ray hatching engine in some form or another. In late 2020, December, I created the first version of this ray hatching thing. And it was because I wanted to experiment with ray tracers and SDFs, which are fine distance functions that are functions that define shapes. You can make a lot of different shapes with them. It was on January the 8th was SDF day. I made a video explaining, and now a lot of people know about SDFs, but that's besides the point. Sorry, I just wanted to play with that. And on the other hand, that is usually done on a graphics video card using shaders, and it is all made for pixel-based outputs. You just calculate the brightness of every pixel on the screen. That's how a ray tracer works. And you shoot a ray through each pixel of the screen. You check what it hits and calculate the brightness there. And that's going to be the color of the pixel. But I had this plotter and for some reason I felt kind of bad about not using it. So I thought for a very long and hard time about how to do ray tracing, but do it on a device that can only draw lines. And you can see on my Instagram, you have to scroll quite a bit back. There's also this article I wrote on FX Hash, on FX Text, it's called that. You can write blog articles and mint them, but everyone can just read it. It's called Ray Hatching Evolution. I can share a link later, then you can put it on Twitter or something. But that explains a lot about the history of this ray hatching algorithm. It went through a couple of steps before it was in the current state. Then at some point, I applied for Artblocks and I did get into the shader-based, GPU-based type of ray tracing just around that moment. So my project with Artblocks was going to be ray traced in the classical way using shaders and pixels and stuff. It was a huge success, but it meant that I had to leave the Ray Hatcher, the line art based program, dormant for a while. I didn't have time to really develop it. But I always knew that I had to go back to it because the outputs were just so striking. Well, around Industrial Devolution, a few months before that, I picked it up again. I actually completely rewrote the program in a way that suited my current programming style, which is a bit more minimal, very short code, a bit better. First version was a bit more elaborate, but it is now faster, better, smaller. So that's the Ray Hatcher. What it does is it can draw 3D scenes in a hand-drawn looking kind of hatched style. Nobody else has done that so far.
Yeah, this is amazing. And the outputs are really stunning and unbelievable. Especially one of your trademarks is this focus on minimal code and optimizing code. And why is that something you focus on this much and really spend time on minimizing?
Well, it started when I applied for Artblocks because my project there called Sculpture, they actually write your code onto the Ethereum blockchain. And that means that every character costs some money to write. This means that you can save a bunch of money if you keep your code short. And depending on gas prices, this can make a huge difference. I think I actually ended up paying all in all about 700, 900 euros to mint Sculpture. But that was because the description also gets written onto the blockchain. And I didn't really thought of minimizing that. And maybe I'm happy that I didn't. Anyway, so that was a reason to keep that code really short. And then I have always have had a real interest in JavaScript, even though it was kind of crappy language way back in the start in the 2000s. So it always fascinated me that because my initial experience with the internet was of static websites. This is maybe for younger listeners a little bit hard to imagine, but every website, it wouldn't move. Well, there would be animated GIFs on it, but they couldn't change their information. You would request it from the server and just get it, and it wouldn't change until you click a link or submit a form. And at some point, it was JavaScript that made these websites suddenly become interactive. At some point, people showed me what this actually meant and what you could do with that. That is a technique called cross-site scripting, which is actually a security exploit that around that time was estimated to affect about 7 out of every 8 websites on the internet. But it was basically the idea that if you type some stuff into a form, it generally gets printed back onto the next web page that you see. And if you write script code into that form and you can get it, then you can get that website to put that script code into its website and you can do all sorts of fun shenanigans. I never really did bad things doing that, by the way. It was just more like showing people that, look, I can make this website do weird stuff. Because it was always about creativity for me. I read a lot of forums about those techniques and people trying the extremes of JavaScript because it was a very funny and weird language with a lot of quirks. I remember this forum called slackers.org, and it was about people talking about JavaScript and stuff, a lot of other stuff too. But I think that is the first time I read about that trick where you can write any JavaScript program using only a very small set of characters that don't look anything like code. This is a really weird quirk of the JavaScript language. But somebody on that forum, I think, figured that out for the first time. They were also really into writing short code because certain forms would only allow for that many characters. So it would be nice if you could do useful things in the shortest amount of code. And already back then, that hugely fascinated me. During the development of Sculpture, it was a little bit of a distraction for me, like when I didn't feel like working on the main features of the project, I would start minimizing the code, picking away, especially near the end of the project. I had a lot of stress also, and I just needed some way to relax, but also not get the code out of my mind too much. So I just started making it smaller, and it gets addictive, you know, because it's a very short dopamine feedback loop. Like you chip away a few characters and then the number goes down. It's like a score, and you just get to repeat that. It's like solving a Sudoku. Sorry, Casper, you're raising your hand. I didn't see how long you were doing that.
Yeah, no worries. I'm just a huge fan of your sculptural work. And of course, one of the things that caught my attention when it was first released was how efficient the code was. Would you mind walking through with us how you actually managed to achieve this kind of code efficiency? Of course, bearing in mind that most of our listeners probably are not native coders. So maybe just at a very high level, help us understand how is it actually achievable to get such efficient code when your graphics are so amazing, right? I mean, our listeners can have a look at the pinned tweet. I've pinned a tweet about the sculptor collection.
Cool. Yeah. So for coders, I can be very short about it because I've already explained for 1.5 hours about the code of Sculpture on the ArtBlocks official YouTube channel. So go check that out if you like it. But for non-coders, it is something that fascinates me, the fact that you can do it. I've also sometimes wondered why. And I wondered sometimes, is it maybe a little bit like, you know, you got these glass bottles with a tiny ship inside them, and people make those with tweezers and stuff. And you think, why? Maybe writing very tiny code is a little bit like that, like building a very tiny ship that will never really sail. There's also the fact that it's all math formulas, ultimately. That means the computer doesn't care what name you give to variables, usually. So you can make all those variables one letter, and the computer will understand it just fine. That already saves an enormous amount of characters. Then there is the building of the code already with the size optimization in mind. So you think, what is a thing that I could do with very little amount of code? How do I leverage the fact that the computer can do a million things in the blink of an eye and use that fact to express something very complicated by describing it very simple? There's a difference that if you have a million ones, you can write a relatively short computer program that says write a million ones instead of writing actual million ones. However, if you have a million random numbers, you need to write a computer program that contains all those random numbers. You can't predict them, so you have to write each of them down. However, if it's the decimals of pi, they are also random. And because it's pi, you can actually write a fairly short program that calculates the decimals of pi. One thing that I like is that now, say you were given a million numbers and they look pretty random and you don't know anything about them, then you're stuck. But what if somebody told you these numbers aren't random, they're pi, but starting from the 5 billionth decimal. Once you know that tiny little bit of knowledge, suddenly this program that was going to be huge, had to include all the digits, can suddenly be written pretty short. Skip the first 5 billion, then start outputting the decimals of pi. That fundamental understanding of what the data you want to generate actually represents can gain you a ability to write very short programs to generate that data. In generative art and the demo scene, we all talk about, or at least in the demo, it's all about faking it. If it looks good enough, then you get away with it. You can cut some corners here and there. I didn't cut a lot of corners because the renderer in Sculptura actually is a quite faithful physical simulation of light rays, actually. That's why it looks photorealistic. But even then, it's not entirely physically correct. You can see some weird stuff here and there if you know where to look. But I think I'm one of the few people who knows where to look.
Yeah, there's no way I can tell that the 3D modeling is imperfect just by looking at the sculptor photos. But thanks so much for explaining. I think I pretty much got it. It's almost like compression techniques, right? What you mentioned, when you have a million ones, instead of writing all the ones in a row, you try to make it like a multiplicative equation. I'm not a native coder, but it sounds logical enough. Still don't really know how it translates to all those beautiful 3D models, but I think it's a good enough basic explanation for our listeners. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if you want to know about the 3D models, somewhere near the start of my YouTube video is how they are constructed. And it's got pictures for people who don't like code or math. If you have two shapes and you put them through each other like ghosts, you have an area where both shapes overlap. That area is called the intersection of two shapes. The thing is that in three dimensions, you can make a bunch of relatively simple shapes like donuts or cubes or balls. If you intersect them with each other in particular ways, complex objects emerge. That was the way how I make all those different sculptures in Sculpture.
Wow. Very cool. Very cool. Thanks for sharing all your secret sources.
Ha. Well, yeah, I already explained a lot about this in other places. Actually, there was one person this January that I saw playing with SDFs who arrived at some very similar shapes that I immediately recognized as being related to the Sculpture formula. I'm pretty sure they weren't trying either. That is also why I made the video about SDFs, because it's such a powerful technique. And I'm doing actually relatively simple things with SDFs, but the end result is beautiful and really complex. I'm now seeing a lot of people learn about SDFs, and that's really cool. People will also start recognizing, oh, wait, this is how Sculpture works. I don't mind. It's written on the blockchain that I made in September 27th of 2021. So I was first.
Nice. That video about SDFs is super helpful, by the way. So we will link that and a lot of other useful resources in the show notes. So people can look it up later and learn more. This is probably also a good time to talk about January, because as you mentioned, SDFs was one of the daily challenges there. So why don't you give us a description of what is January, what the idea behind it, and how does it work?
Yeah, so how it got started was also in October 2020, weirdly around the time the Ray Hatcher got born, but also we were talking with the Generative Artist Club about an event called Inktober, which is a month-long challenge for graphical artists to make line art drawings based on a set of prompts, one for every day of October. That's cool. We wanted to try it, but we quickly found out that these prompts for line art, they just really weren't suitable for code art. Right around that time, someone contacted me about some kind of generative art challenge called Six Simple Lines of Code. It gave you six lines of code and you had to write some art using those lines of code. I thought, hey, that's a pretty cool idea. What if we had like Inktober, but with prompts like this instead? Then I thought, hey, but we obviously should call it January, because that was an obvious pun. And that gave us 3 months to still do it. I figured, well, all I need is like a list of good prompts and a website, and the rest would pretty much take care of itself. I got the help from a whole bunch of people from the Generative Artist Club. We brainstormed prompts and I got some help with the website too. Then we launched January, and right away, the first year, it was a big success. The second year, it was an even bigger success. This year, I think it's slightly even bigger again. So yeah, I did a thing. That's really cool.
Yeah, it truly is. This year, it started with this amazing animation you shared on Twitter, because the prompt was perfect loop. We pinned that tweet to Spaces here, so people should definitely check that out because it's mind-blowing.
Thank you.
I really set off the event on a good note. And there's been so many contributions as well, like in the hundreds of different contributions every day. There's this gallery as well, right? Collecting all the contributions.
Yeah, there are several galleries, actually. There's one on Join, that's J-O-Y-N. They're collecting the January hashtags that are posted to Twitter. Then there is also the open processing website, which is online website where you can create, well, they like to call it sketches with P5.js, which are sort of generative art pieces. I don't know how they classify which ones are from January, but you can also see a lot of the January challenges on open processing.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's super useful. I wanted to ask, when selecting these prompts, what difficulty level are you aiming for, like on average?
Well, that depends a little bit. Originally, I wanted every prompt to be like those 6 lines of code. I thought, what if we had 31 times 6 lines of code? That was the prompts. But as I quickly realized, I'm not going to think of all these prompts by myself. Or even if I try, at some point, you run out of juice and they won't be very good. So I brainstormed them together with other people from the GenArt Club that made me realize that there are really large variety of types of prompts that can be useful and fun for generative artists. Yeah, so I was always happy to include everybody's prompts. And often I would find I didn't think of a certain prompt, or I thought, oh, these prompts are definitely not the type of things that I would think of. All in all, due to voting at the end for which prompts we like the best and then selecting the most popular ones, we always ended up with a really nice varied palette of different prompts that also got me out of the danger of only choosing things that I like, because it's for everybody.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of variety there and so many fun prompts to try, like Glitch Heart or Made in 10 Minutes. That's one of the things we tried several members of the Angel Swing and had a lot of fun. And then there's more challenging prompts like generative music, which was a few days ago, which is certainly a challenge. But yeah, so many fun things to try. And also, people don't have to do every prompt every day on the exact day, right?
No, there's no generative art police who will close your Twitter if you don't. No, we wrote frequently asked questions page as well, and it says, it says all these things. Let me get that page. Do I need to follow the prompt strictly? No. Do I need to post every day? No. Do I need to do the correct prompt on the correct day? No. Does it need to be X? No. Can I? Yes. But please follow the Geneva Conventions. This is important. Maybe we can. Yeah. No. Anyway, there's a lot of silly stuff in the website, if you like that kind of thing.
Yeah, lots of fun stuff. Even the notice at the end with the privacy agreement. So yes, people should definitely take a look at the website. I think one thing that I really like is all of the engagement and excitement on Twitter, especially with people sharing what they're making and lots of good things coming out of it. That sounds like one of the main purpose or driver behind doing this is to get the community together and do all of these different tasks and just have fun, basically.
Yeah, so it is like a challenge. It's going to be the challenge that you set for yourself, ultimately, by which I mean you don't need to do all the prompts. I'm really trying this year, but to be completely honest, I have not been able to do each of the prompts. The first year I left out, I think, a couple of the last 3. Maybe I did them later afterwards. The second year, I only did 20 of them, I think, and also a couple more afterwards. It's really a marathon if you try to do all 31. In the first year, it was my goal, explicit goal, to pull all the different gen art communities together, like Reddit, Instagram, and Twitter, and some creative coding discords, and well, anywhere I could think of, I tried to get people to participate. I focused a little bit less on that this year because I've been very busy with all sorts of other stuff and I didn't have time. I think I will post to some extra Reddit and Instagram afterwards or in bunches if I get the time, because I mostly posted my stuff to Twitter this year. The other thing that I saw after the first year of January was the first year, well, it was probably the best memories, probably because it was the middle of the pandemic. A lot of people were in lockdown. And so it was really nice to have something to do every day. The result of this was that I think I saw everybody level up after seriously trying to partake in January for a month. I think I'm seeing that this year as well. Lots of people learning new skills, trying things outside of their comfort zone. There's even a prompt, I think it was yesterday, yeah, that says something you always wanted to learn. So that's like a free day to just go on a Wikipedia binge if you wanted to. Yeah, it is a challenge you set for yourself, and it is like a training, you know, but generative art is like a muscle that's very hard and specialized to train. So you only get to do this once a year.
It's a great excuse for training. Also, wanted to ask about the generative art community as you see it. Is it mostly kind of part of this crypto gen art movement now, or is there still a divide between the people do this and release on the blockchain and the people that do generative art and don't care about the crypto side of it?
That's a good question. I did hear that demo sceners in general are pretty skeptical about blockchain and blockchain art, but yeah, to be honest, I lost contact with the demo scene in 2003 when I was too busy studying. And if I didn't release anything, it wasn't that fun to go to a weekend with lots of people and computers. In the generative art world, there's not like a divide between those who publish on the blockchain and those who don't. I think everyone that I see do generative art at least has published a few things on the Tezos blockchain, because it's just such a low threshold and there's really no reason not to try it out. Then there's a lot of different degrees of successfulness that I see in the generative art community. People that I know more closely, some of them made it really big, some of them didn't. That's hard to see sometimes, especially from the latter group. You can sometimes hear people say, maybe it was more fun before we did this for money. That's a valid opinion, I guess. But I'm also really thinking, look at the revolution that generative art went through in the past couple of years. So many more people practicing this art. Sorry, you wanted to say something, Johannes?
Yes. So I just wanted to step in. I think it's so great that finally digital artists are able to get money for their art, because it's art and there are collectors for art. I don't see a big difference to physical pieces. So one thing about the demo scene was always it's some kind of nerdy thing that you do at night. You can't pay the rent for this, and then you can't concentrate full time on this. Now with NFTs, it's a very special thing that artists are getting paid for their work. So I think it's so great that now doing coding and NFT world gives money to the artists. I love that fact.
Oh yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I can't speak for the demo scene anymore because I just don't have a lot of contact with people from there anymore.
For the chiptunes, also a lot of people say in the old forums, no, I don't want to do that crypto stuff. But I think, yes, it's art. Why shouldn't it be paid? And if crypto is paying you, why not? It's money.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it is art in Germany. And I think also one or a couple of the Scandinavian countries, they put the demo scene on the UNESCO list of heritage cultural significance. So it is being taken seriously in that case. But yeah, anyway, about generative art, I think it is a different community than the demo scene. I know a lot of generative artists who used to be demo scene, but I don't know a lot of generative artists who are demo scene. There are a couple, though. There's one thing I wanted to add about what has NFTs given to generative art. From the start, it was like a perfect match, you know? There's this thing that got me enthusiastic about generative art and doing long-form piece on that we didn't know was called long-form back then. On art blogs, I saw Dmitry Cherniak's piece of Ringers, and it suddenly dawned on me that it is not just getting paid, which is, of course, extremely cool, but there's also the fact that the experience of generative art has changed, or at least it has grown. The old version is also still there. But back when I used to write generative programs, they were running in the browser and you could refresh them and see a new artwork every time. This was cool. But when I show that to people. They look at them, they press refresh a couple of times, and maybe they really like it. They keep pressing refresh, but in the end, their experience of the piece will be like the total or the average of all the stuff they've seen. Suddenly, NFTs gave people the ability to own a particular piece that allowed people to have a different experience with generative art, because suddenly it is not like one of the outputs. It is still one of the outputs, but this one is yours. And maybe it looks a little bit like a duck. That's what I think is a new capability in the way that we can experience generative art that simply wasn't really there before NFTs came around.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It certainly feels like a perfect match with this ability of using the hash as part of the input and persisting the outputs. So this is very exciting. I think also a big reason why this generative art space is really on a roll these days. So much activity and so many people involved and more day by day. I know also you had one of your recent drops being a live mint, like an in-person mint. We are a bit over time here, but if you wouldn't mind sharing a bit about that experience, how the live minting event was.
Oh, yeah, well, sure. So that was for Industrial Devolution. It was really incredible. I had already been in contact with Bright Moments, the gallery that organized all this. For some time, they asked me to produce a piece for this live minting event in Venice Beach, Los Angeles. I wasn't entirely sure if I was going to get it done because I had just gotten that Ray Hat shirt to a point where I could be starting to experiment to make it long form. But it is hard to write interesting long form, three-dimensional stuff. Long form in general, you have to give a lot of inspiration. I don't like to make the same thing twice. So I had to come up with something, and I had only a couple of months, but somehow I was really motivated, hit the right ideas, and it got better, more interesting. I did a lot of research also into how composition works in paintings. The sculpture has a camera focus in the middle, and it's a very singular type of composition that you have. I wanted Industrial Devolution to have something more complex. I actually think that geomorphism is taking that even a little bit further, but then that's a later project. I have some ideas to make it even more varied. So the live minting experience itself was super cool. The collaboration with me, Bright Moments, FX Hash, and Tender, a curation organization for mostly Tezos blockchain and generative art on the blockchain in general. It was really amazing to just have a team of people put together a show. There were a couple more things going on at this event, but my live minting release was clearly the main event. It was just an incredible experience. Spontaneity, another generative artist who also does a lot of things for Bright Moments, was there as well and got to hang out with him a lot. He's a super nice dude. I met a lot of my collectors as well. One of the biggest collector of sculpture, Beurs Yatier. He also attended the live minting event and I could meet him. And that was very nice. A bunch of other people I knew from online, collectors, artists, a bunch of generative artists, I think, actually came out to Los Angeles just for this show. People from the Gen Art Club, that was super cool. So it was an incredible experience. And afterwards, I thought this was probably one of my goals as an artist. I got to make new goals now.
That's amazing. This live minting, in case people wonder, it works by attendees getting some kind of code that they could use to mint, right?
Yeah, they had these metal cards, passes, the size of credit cards, and they were laser engraved with a QR code. You could just use the QR code to go to a particular link on FX Hash that would be valid for one single mint.
That's great. I know FX Hash has focused a lot on these live minting events lately. There's been several of those, and it's a focus area for them to build out this way of minting as well as a complement to the fully online. Love to see these events. So we are wrapping up, and if any of my co-hosts have any final questions, feel free to mention that. I have one final random question. I read somewhere that when you spoke with Artblocks leading up to the sculpture release, you had two projects in mind that could become the Artplux project, and you chose Sculpture for various reasons. Would you mind sharing what the other one was and how we've seen it on AvexHash, maybe?
Yeah, there were two ideas I was picking between. One of the idea were the mathematical formula that I like to call the epihyperdurpflardioids, which are sort of spirographical, yeah, cool shapes. It's not really that I figured out the formulas, but I later found out some literature of people experimenting with them, but everybody does it slightly different. And I think somebody called them mystery formulas first, and I don't think that's a really cool name. It's based on their mathematical figures called epicycloids and hypocycloids and stuff like that. They're kind of like that, but also different. So I came up with my own word. I made one release for them on AvexHash quite recently for the AvexHash 1 year anniversary. But it was a program that I put together in a couple of days. So it is not quite what it would have been if I would have spent a couple of months on it. That was mainly because it was going to be a 365 edition for one T. So it wasn't super motivated to put one of my most complicated works there. But I've experimented with these formulas more often. There's also a moving version on my website on the peterpasma.nl/epihyperdurpflardioids. You could just type that in your browser and go there. It's probably not linked anywhere else, though. It's definitely a thing I will probably revisit sometime in the future. Although I don't have any present ideas on what really to do with it, because it was a bit harder to come up with something that really has a huge amount of variation. Also, Aaron Penny told me that I should go with the ray tracing stuff because it would blow people's minds.
Yeah, it truly did. So that's great. Thank you. Yeah, I do remember minting a couple of those that you released for the 1 year anniversary of AvexHash. Very fun shapes. So we will include links to that in the show notes. We are wrapping up now. So thank you so much, Peter, for coming on and talking about generative art and January. It's a very fascinating field, and your art is beautiful and very inspiring. So thank you so much. And people should follow you, Peter, on Twitter and go to genuary.org to learn more about this event and participate. It's for everyone. So that's it for today. Thanks everyone for joining and for all the good discussion. And thanks to my co-hosts as well.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for hosting this and having me on. Have a really nice day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. In time.